The Tom Woods Show, episode 726.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're a homeschooling parent and you're tired of running yourself ragged, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And check it out through my special link where you get three free bonuses totaling $160. My special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. Time for a magical mystery tour episode with Michael Malice. And by that, I mean my occasional references to that movie, that TV movie that the Beatles made, I guess, in 1967. The idea being that they would get in a bus and drive around England and they would record whatever happened. And unfortunately, nothing really did happen, and this was considered one of their first real failures. I'm not saying this episode is a failure, but the idea of the episode is the same. We're starting off with a fairly thin premise, and then just seeing where we go with it. So I had tweeted something relating to this whole fiasco of Amy Robach over at Good Morning America, making, inadvertently, to my mind anyway, making a racially insensitive remark. And I tweeted about that, and we'll get into that in a minute. And it turns out that Michael Malice decided to write a whole column for The Observer about it. So we decided, you know what, let's kick this around and see where this discussion goes, because there are a lot of different kinds of issues this can lead to. You all know Michael Malice by now, of course, I hope. You can check him out at michaelmalice.com. He's a celebrity ghostwriter and a very successful and good one, I might add. You can see him regularly on Kennedy, on the Fox Business Network, and on other programs on Fox Business and Fox News. He is also the author, most recently, of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il, an excellent book. All this stuff will be linked at tomwoods.com/726, along with Michael's column. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
A lot of times I have you on, and I don't really know where it's going to go. I just think, look, it's Malice, and he's going to drive the episode, and I'm going to follow, and we're just going to see what happens. Well, in this episode, that is multiplied by 100. I tweeted something out a week or so ago about this controversy about Amy Robach of Good Morning America, whom I'd never heard of because I don't watch Good Morning America. The idea that I would even be awake at that hour to watch, I don't even know when it's on, but if it's called Good Morning, it's way before I'd be awake. And apparently, she was trying her best to make an anti-racist statement, which, you know, you don't get any extra points when you're trying to make an anti-racist statement when you accidentally say something that offends, so-called, the snowflakes. So she said, she was talking about, well, you tell what the topic, because your view is that the thing that she was talking about was the issue that should be broached, not her inadvertent use of an insensitive term.
Well, I mean, I don't know that I agree necessarily. I think it's a complete non-issue from my perspective. But it just speaks to how race in the media is played, where she had a comment where she said that there should be certain movie roles reserved for colored people, right, as opposed to the preferred term, which is people of color. And I think your tweet was something like, having that letter, the word of in there, and a little bit different syntax, you know, is the difference between being in the Klan and being enlightened.
Let me jump in on that. I tweeted out that I said I've never used the term colored people, because of course it reminds me of Archie Bunker from when I was growing up,
right?
So I wouldn't use the term colored people, but I said, but isn't it bizarre that that's unforgivable and that the correct term is people of color? So what is it that it's is it the missing preposition that's the issue? I mean, this is just weird the way the rules of discourse work in America, that you could be that close to being driven out of society just in the way you arrange these words. I mean, I don't care where you stand on the racism spectrum. That's screwed up. That was the point of my tweet. And you latched on to it. You wound up writing a column for The Observer about this. Of course, we're linking to it at tomwoods.com/726. Now, go ahead.
Now, well, my question for you is, was that tweet meant facetiously or rhetorically, or were you sincerely asking, why is this a difference?
I was having fun with these people, because my view is that the difference between the two, obviously there is no substantive difference between the two. Right. To me, it's a matter of it's a matter of these people want to control and dominate all these situations. They want to make clear who's in charge, and you are not in charge. And you will sit there and pathetically beg our forgiveness, and we'll consider whether we're going to grant it. That's the position they like to be in. That's my view.
Well, I think that's the position most people like to be in, to be fair, you know, given the choice of – but the point I made, and I thought that you were being sincere to some extent that you thought is ridiculous. And the point I was making is it's not ridiculous – In the sense that they are being somewhat consistent in their use of language and its role. And its role isn't necessarily to dominate for the sake of dominating. So as I talked about in my article, the term colored is a historic anachronism, right? It used to be the term for black people in the South, especially in the South, back in I don't even know when it started changing to black or African or then Afro-American, then African-American. This was the Jim Crow era. Nowadays, people of color is the term because it refers just to black people, but to non-white Hispanics, and sometimes other people get grouped into that, depending on whether or not the speaker wants to regard them as being oppressed or at that particular moment. So sometimes it means people from the Indian subcontinent in that area. Sometimes it doesn't. I don't think that most people understand how this works because it's not arbitrary. So let me break it down how it works like I wrote in my article. So if I'm a progressive in the religious sense, I want to constantly demonstrate my commitment to the progressive agenda. And one of the easiest ways any group demonstrates their commitment to an ideology is through the use of jargon. We certainly see this in libertarianism. We see this in objectivism. We see this with the Republicans when Republicans talk about, I'm a old-fashioned is a Republican code word, or I'm a real American, or something like that. And progressives have the same thing. So they will use terminology. The problem is everyone wants to use the correct progressive terminology because, as this woman found out, when you don't use the correct progressive terminology, you're going to have negative consequences because they're in a position to hurt people who aren't playing by their rules, right? And this has been demonstrated, more times than you can count. The problem – so now if the progressives want you to use the correct words to demonstrate that you're a progressive, and everyone is going to try to use those correct words because everyone's trying to pass as a progressive, well, that's a problem now because progressives can't identify each other by using the correct words because a lot of people are lying and just using their jargon to, kind of swim with the tide. So then they have to start constantly changing the words that they use in order to have their cues be current, just like clothes. In the same way that, not that long ago, people would say mentally retarded, right? And it was not an offensive term at all. It was used as a descriptor. And then there was this campaign, ban the R word. Jane, whatever her name is, I forget that actress, the comedian, she had a whole video about the R word and how you shouldn't use it. And retarded people are, special and should be cared for. No one is arguing that retarded people are special. This term was not used as approbation. This was a descriptor of people who had mental disabilities.
Yeah, especially just read the dictionary definition of retard.
Right.
That is exactly what we're dealing with.
Right. But no, then it became, everyone is using this term. Therefore, some people who aren't with the program are using it ironically or they shouldn't be using it. So we have to change it. So what happens is when you keep changing these terms, if someone uses an outdated term, that is a cue that they aren't caught up with the program, that they're not on the progressive bandwagon. And they're always looking for outliers to attack and destroy because there's a group of people, who appoint themselves as the police, and now they know who to swarm. So in that sense, I'm not going to say she got what she was asking for. In one sense, though, this is something that could be foreseen because it's something they act this way consistently and repeatedly across different areas.
I saw a series of tweets in response to this whole ridiculous episode with Amy Robach on Good Morning America. And one of the people was saying, I'm going to, and this person was saying this in all seriousness, I'm going to let this slide this once, but if it should happen again, I'm going to watch some show other than Good Morning America. Now, all right, first of all, the preposterousness of the faux outrage of all this, that she failed to put the preposition in the middle of the words and she got them in the wrong order. First of all, how tone deaf about American society would you have to be? If she said this again, she'd be off Good Morning America. That'd be it.
Right.
We would never hear from her again. You wouldn't have the opportunity to say, all right, well, now I'm really going to. And secondly, given the outrage about the ridiculous outrage about her use of this phrase, she's obviously, if she values her career, never, ever, ever, ever going to say this again. So, some of these folks. Now, I mean, I'm not talking about the people who drive these campaigns. I'm talking about the useful idiots, among their followers. I mean, most of them honestly do not understand how American society works. They have vastly overestimated. Everybody who disagrees with them is a white supremacist. It's impossible to have a rational conversation with anybody who is that upset about what was, to my mind, obviously a slip of the tongue and a mistake by her.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because let me explain their view on race, because I think a lot of people who are not progressives get frustrated by their view of race, and they're kind of talking past each other, okay? So this is the metaphor I used. Let's suppose you have a school, and a bunch of kids are in detention, okay? And the teacher for this kind of detention, you have to write an essay saying, you know, what did you do wrong and why you won't do it again. And the teacher who's in charge of detention is grading the papers. And once she says, okay, you did a good job, you can leave detention, right? So she's basically holding the kids in that classroom. Now, someone knocks on the door and tells the teacher, we've got a school shooter. You know, someone's shooting up the school. Get out of here. And the teacher says, well, we're not leaving until I finish grading these papers. And the guy goes, what are you talking about? There's a school shooter. And do not think this is an issue. And the teacher will say, okay, I'll lock the door. Now, if you were the person talking to this teacher, you would think she is either insane or evil. At the very least, you would not respect her and you would ignore her and try to get those kids out of there, right?
Yeah, of course.
So this is their idea of racism. I don't mean you specifically, Tom. I mean, for someone to say that racism is a problem and to acknowledge racism is a problem, but not act immediately as if this is a huge emergency that's happening everywhere in your environment. From their perspective, you're in that position of the teacher. From their perspective, if racism exists, it is an emergency and as pervasive as the school shooter, and locking the door is not going to matter. So when people say, I care about race, I'm not prejudiced, that's not enough for the progressives, because for them, if something is this big of a problem and your response to it is some minor change in behavior, you're dismissing this problem and you're ignoring it when it's on the level of a metaphysical outrage that is happening constantly.
All right. So it's not just – so in other words, in your view, this is not just a raw effort to exert power over other people. It also has roots in a whole way of viewing the world.
Well, I wouldn't use the word roots because of the pun. But yeah, it definitely has – right. It's their worldview. And if – the question that I love to ask people on the left is there a point at which the cost of fighting racism and discrimination outweighs the benefit, right? Is there like a little amount you could be happy with? And many people who are on the left who are approaching this from a rational perspective, who think we should live in a country where people are treated fairly, that mentality of which I subscribe to, they'll say, yeah, of course, you're never going to be able to eradicate it. You know, everyone's going to have their prejudice, grandma, and that's fine. But the evangelical progressives, even asking that question to them is insane and makes you morally suspect.
Let's shift gears a bit, but still on the same general theme. I'm pretty sure you know who Bette Midler is, of course, right?
I have a funny story with her, but yeah, go ahead.
I'm sure you do. Well, the story that I know of is apparently sometime in the last, I don't remember when I read this news item. Did you read it where she made some, what she thought were humorous remarks about Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner?
No, I didn't hear this.
Oh, yeah. And they were obviously meant in fun. And of course, she. What do you think happened? Do you think people said those are funny jokes, or do you think they said, "Well, Bette, I know you think those are funny jokes, but you may be a little bit behind the times. We actually don't consider those jokes to be admissible anymore." Do you think that was the response?
Wait, Bette. Oh, wow. She apologizes for offensive Caitlyn Jenner tweet. I never heard about this.
Yeah. So she apologized. Yeah. Now, I mean, look, I'm not saying it's impossible ever to offend someone or that everything you might want to say is a good thing to say. I'm not saying, you know, nobody's saying that. What fascinates me is just the process that we all know. We all know what's going to happen to that person. We know the exact process. There's going to be the ritual denunciations. It's like a liturgy.
Yes.
And then the response is the abasement and the firm commitment to amendment of life. I mean, it is bizarre. I mean, it's just. I'm curious about your comments on that.
Why is it bizarre if it's something that follows something that's already had precedent? It's the opposite of bizarre.
I guess it's the precedent that's bizarre.
Progressivism is just Christianity without the mythology. So, of course, they're going to use the historical methods that have worked because they have worked. So they're conservatives in that sense. So why would they try to reinvent the wheel? And there was an episode of your show with Vox Day, and he has that book where he just goes through the steps, a fellow Bucknell alum, where he just goes through the steps of how this works.
What did you think about the statement that appeared in the acceptance letter for the class of 2020 from the University of Chicago? I assume you saw that?
Yeah, they were talking about no safe spaces and no trigger warnings, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think about that?
The wonderful thing about the fringe rights, for lack of a better term, in social media is that they are forcing people who don't want to talk about these things to talk about them and acknowledge them. Because if you are in a position of dominance, you don't have to explain yourself to anybody. The Fed doesn't have to explain itself to anybody. They are just going to do what they want with their money and keep it secret. Same thing with the CIA, FBI, or all these other government, Homeland Security especially. They're not accountable. So when you have complete progressive domination of the universities, from their preferred method, they're going to do as they please, and you're not in a position to question. And it's funny when a lot of libertarians are like, oh, these are private institutions, so they don't have to answer anybody. Well, that's not – they don't literally – have to answer to anybody, but in a free market, you're perfectly allowed to critique other, you know, any business's options, and they can choose to answer or not as they want. So the fact that, you know, these, what Thatcher back in the day called the loony left, the fact that they have to account themselves and be like, why are you overturning things like innocent till proven guilty? And why are you claiming to be for an honest exchange of ideas, but have those ideas delineated so narrowly that there's no point in exchange? You know what I mean? It's like, let's have free money, but the only penny money you can use are pennies. It's like, this is not an actual free exchange. So we all knew that there was going to be a pushback and that it's starting. And frankly, I think here's my prediction. I think before you get a pushback in terms of free speech being to some extent reintroduced in campuses, it's going to be much more likely that the having a university diploma is increasingly looked at as pointless and a waste of money.
I'm not as optimistic on that last point. I think it's so entrenched in the mentality of middle-class parents that their ticket to upper-middle-class respectability is to have a college graduate child, that I think they are willing to sit through abuse and insanity and absurdity of all sorts in order to get that ticket. I believe that the social pressure is just too great not to put their kids in that environment. So it's going to be like pulling teeth, I think, to get them to change their practices. I do want to comment on this idea. I'm so sick of having to clarify this. Every time I critique a private institution, I actually get some libertarian who says, but it's a private institution. They're allowed to do X, Y, or Z. So it means I have to insert a caveat in every single thing I say that, yes, I know they have the right to do it. But just because they have the right to do it doesn't mean I can't criticize them for doing it. So these libertarians have bought into the leftist idea that libertarians are not allowed to critique corporations. You know, they're not allowed to critique private property owners. Yes, of course we are. What? That's a crazy idea.
My favorite example of this is, it's like, well, if Ayn Rand didn't believe in Social Security, why was she taking their checks? Checkmate, libertarians. And it's like, yeah, if Ayn Rand thought money was being stolen from her and there's some that's being returned to her, why wouldn't she keep it?
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't she say it would be better in my hands than in the hands of the moochers and the looters?
Of course. So this idea that we can never criticize anyone else's actions is just if you're a libertarian, you have a roommate, you know, and the roommate, you know, has an equal voice in your house. You can't tell him to turn the music down. What?
Yeah, it's nuts. So look, yes, I am allowed to critique places and to celebrate when people do the right thing. So yeah, I sent out an email to my list about that University of Chicago thing, because when I was on Milo's show recently, he said that what he expected to happen was that it's getting so bad that there will be universities that will look to differentiate themselves on precisely this basis. And the reward for that is that they will attract students who just have no time for crap like this and who probably do take their studies seriously, and this has to benefit them. And I think it was a really smart PR move, and they didn't do it in the form of a press release. They sent it out as the admissions acceptance letter to all these students, knowing full well it would be on the internet within 10 seconds of the first kid opening it.
Yeah, but the problem is where these ideas are most entrenched are usually the most prestigious universities. So I'm surprised and delighted that it's a university on the caliber of the University of Chicago that was the first one to break free, because you'd expect it would be some kind of second or third tier school or even a fourth tier school like Bucknell. They would be the ones who are going to try to compete on this level, because this is a very big deal to stick your neck out against this kind of egalitarian progressive monopoly in academia. What I want to know is, you went to Columbia, you know, just like Alexander, you and Mattress Girl and Alexander Hamilton. You speak to a lot of young college kids. From your perspective and the feedback you've gotten, has it gotten worse or better since you were at Columbia and places like that?
Oh, I think it's much worse now, actually. And I remember at the time thinking it couldn't get any worse, but it's much worse now. Now, as a grad student, I didn't really have time to worry about any of that. I really, really was seriously busy. So I didn't really join any student groups or anything. But when I did look around, I noticed there really weren't any student groups worth joining. There was the College Republicans, who were absolutely hopeless. I mean, in a way, it's almost understandable. They were so outnumbered. But as an undergrad at Harvard, there were vastly more. Partly it's because the freshman class is four times larger. But there were vastly more student groups, and there were ones that were actually congenial. And we had fun because we would shock the campus by doing things that we weren't supposed to do, you know, that were off the 3x5 card, and that would get the narrative going in our direction. People would have to engage with us, and so that we had some fun doing stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, now it's partly that the resistance to all this has moved so far leftward that now you're just reduced to resisting only the most ridiculous, absurd, preposterous aspects of all of it. So yeah, it's pretty bad, and I think what it makes people inclined to just you know, most people don't want to be called haters, and they don't want to deal with everybody boycotting them and ostracizing them. So I think most people outwardly will just go along, but inwardly they'll feel like there's something wrong with this, but I just can't – there's nothing I can do about it. I just have to go on.
Can I tell you a funny story of when I went to Bucknell about this issue? It's really, really hilarious.
I know that your Bucknell experience was not very good because I read Ego and Hubris, but I'm sure, yes, I don't know this particular story.
I allude to it. So Ego and Hubris, for those of you who don't know, Harvey Pekar, the late Harvey Pekar of American Splendor fame, wrote a book about me called Ego and Hubris, The Michael Malice Story. I wanted to call it The Little Engine That Could But Shouldn't, but Ballantyne said that was no dice, so okay, we called it Ego and Hubris. So I was in College Republicans, okay? And if you wanted to get a notice about your club meeting, you had to email students@bucknell.edu. And whoever was monitoring that inbox would approve your message. And once approved, it would go to every student's inbox, right? So there was a gatekeeper. And it was frustrating because there was a couple of times when I would send out a notice and the email only went out like 2 days later. So like I think at one time it was even after the meeting had happened. I don't remember, but it was a source of frustration. Now, there was a group on school who decided to have something called Jeans Day to show your support for gay rights. Now, if there's one thing I hate more than anything, it's hypocrisy. And the Bucknell student body back then, and I'm sure now, well, now is very different. It was very socially conservative. And coming from New York, this is something I didn't jibe with very well at all. So they had Jeans Day to support gay rights, but they barely advertised it. So then they could say, look, everyone's in jeans. You know, this is a campus that supports gay rights. So that drove me crazy. So some girl emailed students@bucknell.edu about some minor issue. I don't remember what it was. And she wrote, P.S., I'm not wearing jeans today, but I still support gay rights. Okay. And this went out to everybody. And this drove me crazy because I'm like, why are they forwarding this girl's stupid note to everyone at Bucknell? So I emailed them Friday at like 4:45, something else. I'm like, hey, can you guys do a better job of moderating these messages? And I wrote, P.S., I'm not in jeans. I support family values, right? Just to give her the finger. Thinking it's going to go to the person moderating this account. It didn't. What had happened in the interim between my last message and her message is apparently they just let that email account be unmonitored. So my email immediately went to every student and school.
Oh, no.
Right? And one student says, Michael, you just found out that this email account is unmoderated, but since it was Friday at 4:45, all weekend people were emailing this account and every email was hitting every student, and we brought down the Bucknell email server.
Oh.
and it was hilarious. And then I had to kind of like eat crow a little bit because I was being facetious. But then it's like, what do you mean by this? Blah, blah. I didn't have any negative consequences. I'm sure now I would probably be literally murdered. But it was a very funny moment.
It goes to show, by the way, though, that I think one of the things that people are learning on the college campuses is exactly what the limits on what they're allowed to think are. Like, that is absolutely conveyed to them. It is made absolutely clear. Now, there will
no,
be some.
It's not. No, you're wrong.
Oh, all right. Correct me.
This is the whole point of my article. The limits are not clear. The limits are constantly changing.
Okay.
And that's
all right.
How they determine who to punish, who hasn't caught up with the latest limits.
Okay. I guess, but the thing is, if you avoid entire areas of life altogether, if you have no comment whatsoever, nothing's going to happen. Don't try. Is basically what you're encouraged to do. Don't try,
right?
Because even when you try to be friendly, there's a possibility that maybe you were condescending, so they'll get you for that. You understand that there are certain areas of life that can't be talked about, debated, whatever, and that is or what you learn is the people who do speak up against that are viewed as obnoxious, terrible, outcasts from society. They're made examples of, and. I mean, I think people learn that more than they learn other stuff these days.
Yes, obedience. And coming from the Soviet Union, this kind of mindset was very, very familiar to me. And in fact, when I went to North Korea, and again, I really do want to make clear, I'm using this as a very broad metaphor. I hate it when people, you know, compare America to North Korea. It drives me crazy. There's things in North Korea that are universal to human experience. So when I was there, I thought to myself, they are going to have rules about free speech because you can't literally control everything that everyone says. People have to be able to talk about the weather or so on and so forth. There have to be rules that are unspoken but understood by the populace. And I wanted to figure out how that works in North Korea. And the rules in North Korea are, number one, you don't criticize the government, especially the leaders. And number two, you have to pretend like everything's fine all the time. And in a way, number two is a caveat of number one, a corollary, excuse me, because if you're saying something's wrong, and since the government's providing everything, by saying something's wrong, you're saying the government's providing something incorrectly. And there's this video on Vice, the Vice guy to North Korea, and Shane Smith goes there, and he goes to this huge ballroom, and it's empty at the hotel, and the waitress is giving him food, and he goes, this is a huge ballroom, where's everybody? And she goes, they just left. And he laughs at, like, you know, look how crazy these people are. And it's not that she's crazy, it's that she's a great improv artist, because if you have a huge ballroom, you can't say this ballroom is here as a waste and the government's making a mistake. You have to very quickly have some reason why you'd have a ballroom without people in it. So that's their rule. And again, this is universal. Whenever someone has control, they're going to have certain rules about what you can and can't say that are usually actually fairly understandable. And like you identified with progressives, there's certain areas of speech where don't talk about it because we're in a position to arbitrarily do things to you, whether you like it or not, whatever your intentions are. Because for that to work, if you're speaking a taboo, all that matters is, did you hurt somebody else's feelings? Or not even, am I going to say you could have hurt someone else's feelings if they were here? Because usually the offense is on behalf of somebody else as opposed to the person actually being offended. It is much easier. I've worked with many people of color on books. It's much easier to offend a white person about these issues than someone who's actually a minority.
All right. So now I want you to leave us with some advice. Vox Dei has a way of handling this, but it's pretty, throw hand grenades everywhere. Not that I'm opposed to that, metaphorically, but, let's suppose you're just a regular person of goodwill. And you've got to navigate a society where, as you say, the rules are changing and the lines are changing and what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do is changing. What should you do? How do you cope?
That's a great – well, I'll tell you this. It's if you're an average person of goodwill, in a sense, you're screwed. Because if you are in a position without power – you're going to be at the mercy of somebody else regardless. I mean, this was, again, one of the big messages from growing up in a Russian household, that there are going to be people who are stronger than you, and they might do things to you, and there's nothing you could do about them. So I think most people intuitively have figured it out, certainly by the time they've graduated college, because they've seen other people made examples of, and that's the lesson they're taught. So I don't think I have any advice that is going to be particularly useful that they haven't deduced on their own and that you haven't talked about in this episode.
See, this is why people sometimes get on my case. Why do you favor people who are – they think somebody like Milo is obnoxious. And why are you giving support to him? Well, because we're living in this crazy, bizarro system where the rule – as you say, the rules of what's allowed to think and say and do and whatever changes all the time. And if you get it wrong – you can be completely ostracized, or you have one tweet and you get on the plane. By the time you land, your life is over. Your life is over. That's not normal. That is insane. And well, so if somebody's a little bit over the top in fighting against that, that is down at number 100 on my list of 100 concerns.
Well, you also touched on something I think a little unintentionally when people say, oh, why do you support Milo? There's also this idea that this technique that they use where having a guest on your show is endorsement. And I've told you, when I do my next book, I will talk to any group at any time. And frankly, the more they disagree with me, the more I'm in a position to change their mind. I don't want to be preaching to the choir all the time. I think a lot of times we all get into echo chambers where we only talk to people who we agree with. But that's another technique that progressives use. If you only talk to other progressives, that creates the appearance that progressivism is the only valid thing to talk about, and your truth has to be somewhere in this Overton window.
All right. People should check out your column for sure. So tomwoods.com/726 is where they can find that link, plus all the episodes, all those Michael Malice episodes in one convenient place. They can be found right there on that page. Michael, thanks for being here. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
He's the boy you hate to love.
Well, that's a good, interesting way of putting it. You should check out Ego and Hubris. If I haven't got that up on that page, I want to make sure we do that, Ego and Hubris, because I'm telling you, you think to yourself, I'm not sure I want to read a book about Michael Malice. Oh, yes, you do.
Who would say that? Yeah. Who would ever say that? What kind of racist dope?
I'm talking about somebody who's just a drive-by who just accidentally listened to this episode. My regular listeners are dying to read a book about Michael Malice.
Only a racist dope would not want to read that book.
I'll tell you, when I get to the part of that book where you wrote that letter about the person, the type of person you would want as your advisor at Bucknell.
Oh, yes.
And if you didn't get it, what you were going to do. I just burst out laughing, like just laughing out loud. I was in a hotel room with Heather, and I just, she's doing some schoolwork, and I just laughed out loud all of a sudden. What is this all about? I couldn't read the letter with a straight face, which ruined it. I mean, you got to read that deadpan because that's what makes it so funny, and I couldn't. Couldn't do it. All right. Thanks again, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. A couple things to tell you here. if you're thinking about writing, you want to write for some outlet, but you don't know where to submit your writing, and you're just nervous about it, and you don't know how to get started and all that, I'm going to give you a suggestion. There is yet another site created by a Tom Woods Show listener, and they are soliciting material. So you might start there. The website is loveliberty.net. And the owner tells me it's a libertarian news website covering politics, economics, policy, and history from a libertarian angle. He has posts, relatively recent posts, called The Peril of American Empire, 214 down, many more to go, The Unjustified Criminal Justice System, all kinds of posts along these lines. He says, plus, Love Liberty is partnering with Liberty Memes, which I talked to one of their admins on episode number 710, to sell T-shirts that feature the Hillary Clinton meme that we talked about that got Liberty Memes into so much trouble. They're available on the Facebook pages of Liberty Memes and of Love Liberty. And he also says what I've been telling you, that loveliberty.net is looking for anyone who wants to write articles about politics, economics, policy, or history. You can reach out to the owner at politicalbaxter on Twitter, or you can email him at timbaxter@loveliberty.net. So check out loveliberty.net, whether you are a writer or a reader, to help out a fellow Tom Woods Show listener, and if you're a writer, to give yourself a little bit of exposure. I'm going to link to loveliberty.net as the listener website mentioned over at tomwoods.com/726. And remember, you get all kinds of wonderful goodies from me if you start up your website through my link. So make sure you check out tomwoods.com/publicity before you get started, because only then will you qualify to get all the incredible goodies that I have created for you, including a nice brand new private Facebook group for Tom Woods Show bloggers and website owners to exchange ideas and, in general, to plot, which is one of my favorite pastimes. Second thing I want to tell you is what's coming up tomorrow. Well, Scott McConnell is coming back onto the show because he has a brand new book, and it's about his own experiences, but there's a lot of great history and current events, good material in it. It's called Ex Neocon. That's the whole title, Ex Neocon. Great. So Scott will be the guest tomorrow. I hope you can join me. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.